Today on the 21st Show, a conversation reflecting on Jewish life and history in Central Illinois. Some communities have grown, others have faded away. We'll talk with a woman who helped set up the Central Illinois Jewish Communities Archives and a grad student who's working as an archivist for that project. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WNIJ in Rockford DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And today happens to be Purim, or Purim, one of the more joyful celebrations on the Jewish calendar. It marks a biblical story in which Jewish people were saved from a potential massacre in ancient Persia. Coincidentally, we are taking a few days off this week and so revisiting some of our favorite conversations from the past. Today, Jewish history in Central Illinois. Decatur and Danville's Jewish communities were once thriving, but now the synagogues in both cities are closed. Congregation Anshi Knesset Israel in Danville closed in 2012, and Temple B'nai Abraham in Decatur in 2022. In between, however, came the Central Illinois Jewish Communities Archive. It was set up in part by a longtime resident of Danville, Sybil Mervis, who, when we spoke last year, was 90 years young. The aim of the archive was to remember and document local Jewish history and community. Sybil has been aided in that work by Amanda Riggenbach, a graduate student archivist at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She works directly with that archive. We'll hear from her later in the hour. I spoke with both of them last October, shortly after the High Holy Days, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. We're revisiting that conversation today. Because our program's on tape, we're not taking calls, but you can always let us know what you thought. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. talk@21stshow.org. All right, Sybil Mervis, thanks again for being with us. How was your Yom Kippur? Maybe you can just start by telling us what the holiday means to you.
The holiday means that I think about all the things I might have done that I shouldn't have done, and how I can improve my life and do things nicely for other people. And so it's an introspective holiday, and one that you really assess your life and how you're living it.
Do you have any particular rituals or routines that you or your family do every year?
Well, I don't, because I live in Danville, Illinois, and there's only 4 Jews left in Vermilion County. So unless I go to my synagogue, which is in Carmel, Indiana, there's not much I can do in the way of rituals. It's very lonely. I just didn't have the energy to drive to Indianapolis for services this past week. I did go for Rosh Hashanah. And so it's just a lonely holiday for me.
Yeah. We'll talk more about that a little later, but maybe we can look back at earlier times when there was more of a thriving community in parts of Central Illinois. What brought your ancestors to the Midwest?
We think that the Stern ancestors, my father's ancestors, came to St. Louis following a rabbi who was an expert on water. They came from Eastern Europe. They were very poor. Things had been very bad in Russia because of the Russia-Poland, because of the czars, who were so anti-Semitic and so cruel to anybody who was Jewish. So they needed to get out, and they were fortunate that they could get out. And so they went to St. Louis and then moved upwards from there. One relative went to Springfield and started a furniture store. My grandfather moved all the way up to Bloomington from St. Louis with 5 little children under 7. And started a secondhand furniture store there. And they thrived in working very hard in downtown Bloomington. and were very successful for over 80 years.
You were a child during World War II, during the Holocaust.
Oh, yes.
What do you remember of that time?
Well, I was only 10 when the war was over. And I remember listening to Gabriel Heater and Edward R. Murrow talk in the morning, give the news about the war while Daddy shaved. I remember our efforts as children during the war. We had wagons and we collected old newspapers in our neighborhood and took them to school where the older boys piled them up and sold them to the scrap dealer, who then sold them to whoever needed to make more paper. We collected old cans and any kind of metal objects and brought them to school so that they could give those to the, or sell those probably, to the scrap companies in town. I remember bringing 15 cents each week to buy a stamp for the war bond book. And after you had $18.75 worth of stamps in your war bond book, then you bought a bond, which actually was supporting the government so that they can invest the money in whatever they needed to fight the war. I remember walking in parades very proudly in my scout uniform, honoring the soldiers, and making tray favors for the soldiers who were in the hospitals. So we did what we could as children to help the war effort.
Did you have any sense of the horror that was unfolding in Europe, specifically for people who are Jewish?
No, I had no sense of it until 1945, when the war was over and Life magazine showed photographs, horrible photographs, of the victims of the Holocaust. Those images have stayed with me all these years, for more than 70 years. That was my first awareness of what had gone on in Europe.
Had you experienced any sort of anti-Semitism yourself here in Illinois?
Not as a child, a little bit as a high schooler, various times, but not as a child. I was fortunate that way. I didn't realize until I was reading about it a couple years ago how much anti-Semitism there still was after the Second World War. And I know times when remarks were made to my family, but my parents were pretty protective, evidently, so I wasn't aware of it.
You've said you grew up in a beautiful house by the Bloomington Country Club, but that Jews were not allowed to join that country club.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. What about that swim meet? Can you tell me about the swim meet at Lakeside Country Club?
No, because at Lakeside Country Club, everyone was invited. Lakeside was the country club in Bloomington. There were two country clubs in Bloomington, basically, Lakeside and Bloomington Country Club. Jews and Catholics weren't allowed to belong to Bloomington Country Club, so we belonged to Lakeside, which had a pond, obviously. But there wasn't anything different or hurtful about belonging there.
Yeah. Okay. I understand that this time in your life, right, is your childhood as a middle-class kid in middle America. It's the subject of a new exhibit at the Illinois State Museum's branch in Lockport. Maybe we can just do a brief divergence into that. How did that come about?
I wrote a book about 9 or 10 years ago about my childhood. It was a series of 45 little vignettes or essays that I wrote periodically in the evening after supper as part of an exercise, because I was taking a writing class at the Newberry Library in Chicago. So I had these 45 little stories, and I didn't know what to do with them. And a friend who's a publisher said, "Why don't you make a book out of them?" Well, okay. So I made a book out of them called In the Middle, growing up in the middle class in the middle of the 20th century in the middle of the United States. And that was that. I gave it to my grandchildren, and hoping that they would someday be interested in what their grandmother did when she grew up, because it's so different from what the way people, young people, live now. And I was working with the archivist from the Illinois State Museum on another project, and she happened to spy the book. She asked if she could read it. I said, "Take it." So she took it, and a week later she called me and said, "The museum would like to make an exhibit based on your life as a child." in the middle of America, in the middle of the 20th century, in the middle class. Well, I couldn't have been more surprised, but that's what we're doing. It opens Saturday afternoon, the 18th of October, in a beautiful little spot in a darling little town called Lockport, which is 4 miles north of Joliet. And it'll run until June 1st, evidently. And it's based on a childhood, a simple childhood, a typical childhood in central Illinois in the 1940s.
I wonder if Judaism figures at all into this exhibit.
Well, only there's two or three incidences of that, but not a lot.
So let's return to your early life in Bloomington. It's a non-majority Jewish community, but it seems like Jewish people and store owners looked after one another. Strong community. Talk about that sense of that you had back then.
Well, Jewish immigrants moved to small towns where they might be able to have a store or a shop back in the early part of the 20th century. And many of them had ready-to-wear shops for men or women. Some of them, later immigrants from Eastern Europe, had auto parts shops or scrap yards. A lot of junkyards were owned by Jewish immigrants who came to America with nothing, couldn't speak the language, and ended up in a small town where they would go out and collect what other people didn't want and then sell it to somebody bigger. So there was a real cadre of Jewish businessmen in small towns across central Illinois. And they raised their children in these small communities with the idea that they were going to get a college education. I know that neither of my parents went to college for more than a part of a semester, but we three children in our family knew that we had to graduate college before life could start. That was a given. There was no discussion about it. And so we were educated, and once we were educated in the early 50s and the early 60s, we didn't want to live in a small town anymore because there wasn't a group of Jewish people to associate with. And so we moved to big cities. At about the same time, big companies like State Farm and GE started hiring Jewish people, which they hadn't done much of before that. And so there were opportunities in big cities. So there you have the Jewish immigrants who were in the business, and they were getting older, and their children were gone. And so the Jewish community dwindled in each of these towns. That's true in Danville. It's true in Decatur, true in Mattoon, Quincy, to some degree in Springfield, and certainly Champaign. And you have to remember that the biggest department stores in these small towns in central Illinois were owned by Jewish men. They were founded by Jewish men. And so they were very successful. And education was the most important gift that they could give to their children.
And it's interesting that I mean, assimilation, I think, is part of the story as well. And your parents, what did they say to you about the importance of marrying a Jewish man?
My father bopped me on the head every day and said, be nice to everybody, marry a Jewish boy. Every single morning I heard that.
Every morning. Why was that important to them?
Because it was safer to be, first of all, you stay within your own religions. And second of all, it was safer to stay with Jewish people because you couldn't tell what was going on in the minds of other people back then. Mm. Even now.
Yeah. But before we move on from your childhood, I wonder, there's a Yiddish word I want to ask you about, and please correct me if I have the pronunciation or any other aspect of this wrong, but it's schnurrer?
A schnurrer?
It's a
Jewish beggar.
Okay, yeah. So it's a very real concept from your childhood, right, in small town. Can you speak on that?
Yes. Schnurrers were Jewish beggars who would come through town on the train or the bus or however, hitchhiking. And they'd go up and down Main Street looking for a Jewish business. And if they saw a name on a Jewish business, they'd go in and put their hand out and need some money or lunch or money to get to the next town. And my father was one of four brothers, and he handled the schnorrers who came into Stern's Furniture Store. And he'd give them money for lunch and take them to the bus station so they could get on the bus to go to the next place and do the same thing next time. But Jewish people handled their own beggars. They like to think that they took care of their own. That's where that word came from.
Was there any resentment with that, or was it viewed as a sort of an obligation to community or faith?
It's an obligation. You took care of your own.
Let me reintroduce our conversation. My guest today is Sybil Mervis, a Jewish community member and city leader in Danville, Illinois, and one of the founders of the Central Illinois Jewish Communities Archive, set up to help remember Jewish life and community here in Central Illinois, especially in places like Danville, like Decatur, where the community has not been growing and, in fact, has been in such decline that the primary synagogues in those places closed in 2012 in Danville, 2022 in Decatur. A little later in the hour, we'll be joined as well by Amanda Riggenbach, who is with us in studio. She is a graduate student archivist at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, who works directly with that archive. We're going to take a break on the program. Before we do, I want to mention that you can go right now to our website, 21stshow.org, and find conversations with U.S. Senate candidates. There are 16 men and women running in the Democratic and Republican primaries, which is coming up March 17th. Early voting is already underway. We've interviewed all but three of them. The remaining three either didn't respond to our inquiries or did not get to us to schedule an interview in time, but you can hear 13 interviews, in-depth conversations, the kind of thing you will not find in many other places in this current media environment, but you can hear them going on at length in their own words, defending and talking about their campaign policy positions and preferences and what they would do if elected the next U.S. Senator from Illinois. Again, that is all at our website right now, 21stshow.org. It's pinned to the top of the page, very easy to find. You can also find those conversations in our podcast archives. We're on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. Just search for The 21st Show. All right, we will be back after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are spending the program today revisiting a conversation on a century of Jewish life and community in Central Illinois. Last October, I spoke with Sybil Mervis, a longtime resident of Central Illinois. Back in 2021, she helped set up the Central Illinois Jewish Communities Archive to document the Jewish history of the region. Also with us in studio that day was Amanda Riggenbach, a grad student archivist at the University of Illinois in Urbana, who works with the archive. We'll hear more from her later on. Because our program's on tape, no calls today, but you can always let us know what you thought. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. All right, Sybil, you eventually, you mentioned going to the University of Illinois. What was that like?
It was fine. When I transferred from Barnard College to the University of Illinois in January of 1955, my parents wanted me to join a sorority. At that time, you had to make a choice. You either went to Jewish Rush or Gentile Rush. You couldn't do both.
And they were separate. That's interesting.
Yes, okay. They were separate. Yeah. You had to make a choice. I wanted to go through Gentile Rush because I'd grown up with Gentile kids. But my parents insisted that I go through Jewish Rush, and that was fine. And it worked out very well. I worked for the Daily Illini as a student, and I graduated a semester early because I wasn't a beer drinker and I wasn't a sorority girl type, and I just didn't fit in so well.
Maybe if you had gone with the Gentile Rush, you might have had a longer time in college.
No.
No.
I just needed to get out. I didn't go to basketball or football games. I didn't fit.
Yeah. What was your connection to Judaism during college? How did that change?
Oh, it didn't change because of the university at all. I wasn't active in Hillel, and outside of belonging to a Jewish sorority, I wasn't involved in anything Jewish that I recall. That's a long time ago, you know.
Yeah. I wonder, was anti-Semitism at all a factor in your experience at school?
Not that I recall right now.
Yeah. I understand you also got to meet Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, yes. Oh,
tell me
yes.
about that.
Oh, that was exciting. She came to speak at the U of I, and there was a reception for her at Hillel, and I was absolutely determined to shake her hand. So I stayed out past curfew, which was 9 or 9:30 on a Wednesday night, so that I could meet Eleanor Roosevelt. She was one of my first heroines.
And this would have been post, after she was first lady, right?
This would have been in 55 to or 56. I can't remember which.
Okay. You should mention to our producers, should walk you, when you leave our studios today, we have a photo of her speaking in a front of a WILL microphone from around that era. I wonder if it might have been perhaps even the same visit. Okay. What did that mean for you, meeting Eleanor Roosevelt?
She was a strong woman and outspoken. And that appealed to me very much.
So I wonder how the Jewish community has changed in Champaign-Urbana from when you were a student here.
I don't know about Champaign-Urbana. I just know about Danville and a little bit about Bloomington.
Sure. All right. When did what brought you to Danville then?
My husband. I moved to Danville in 1958. There were two congregations in Danville at the time. There was a fading Reformed Jewish congregation on the corner of Fairchild and Walnut. And one block north, there was a fairly vibrant conservative congregation that survived until 2012.
And that's congregation
Anshei Knesset Israel.
Anshei Knesset, yeah, Israel. You know, I feel remiss that I asked you about your parents wanting you to marry a nice Jewish boy, but I didn't actually talk about meeting your late husband, Lou, and what he was like when you first met him. Can you tell us that?
Well, there was a Jewish youth group that encompassed all Jewish teenagers from Danville to Quincy, from Peoria to Mattoon, Decatur, and we met every couple months to be together, and it was a very comfortable group. A lot of kids, probably 70 teenagers, and I remember meeting Lou Mervis at a picnic, and he was standing with several other teenage boys, and my impression was that he was far more mature and less jerky than most teenage boys.
<That's> saying something.
I was impressed with him. I was 15 and a half. I wasn't exactly looking for a husband, but I was impressed with him and had a teenage crush on him. We had one date in high school because he was dating a girl from Quincy whose father also had a scrapyard. And then he went away to Indiana University and I went to Barnard. We didn't see each other for several years. And then when we got back together, it took 2.5 days before we were engaged.
2.5 days?
Mm-hmm.
Was that pretty common back then?
I don't know. I've only been engaged once, so I don't know.
Fair response.
But it was beshert, which is a Yiddish word for meant to be.
Okay.
And I moved to Danville. He had just been the first person in his family to graduate from college. He came back with an accounting degree to the junkyard, his 5-acre junkyard that his father owned, with all kinds of ideas to which his father said no. And Lou did them anyway and built the business into one of the largest family-owned scrap businesses in America. And I was right along with him doing anything that needed to be done to make life better for everybody in Danville, Illinois.
Tell me about the congregation you joined. When did that first open?
That congregation opened probably in 1920. It was then more Orthodox than conservative. They moved into a former Catholic church near downtown. The congregation was made up of people who work with their hands, as opposed to the German Jewish congregation, the Reform congregation, which was made up of storekeepers for the most part. And they struggled along. They were in two other buildings, and then the third old church building they were in was in a neighborhood that became a drug neighborhood, and we needed to get out of there. So somebody died and left us a large sum, and we were able to buy the Ridgeview Baptist Church behind the Custard Cup. And that became our congregation building, even though it was far larger than we needed. And we needed to change it from a Christian building to a Jewish building. And that was my challenge. And we did it. And it became the most beautiful Jewish sanctuary in Central Illinois.
I understand you had a role in designing the stained glass windows and the arc.
I had a role in creating the entire thing. I didn't design the stained glass windows, the artist did. But we had 11 stained glass windows, and they represented the Jewish holidays, and one window represented the Holocaust. It was the first time we'd ever had our own stained glass windows.
Well, maybe that's an interesting point. It's the first time you've ever had your own. You had one representing the Holocaust. What was memory of that like at that time? Because I think for people today, there is a lot of emphasis, obviously, on talking about the Holocaust. I think I've read, correct me if I'm wrong, back then, some people didn't want to talk about that so much, that it took time for those conversations to sort of grow and develop to where they are today.
We had several survivors who were members of our congregation, and they weren't saying anything. And then in the mid-1980s, there was some kind of a gathering of Holocaust survivors in America, I think in Washington, D.C. And after that, there was a couple, the Meckels, who came back, and we had a gathering in our living room of people who were interested, and they told about some of the things that had been perpetrated on them during the Holocaust. And after that, they were willing, more willing to speak of it than they had been before that gathering in Washington.
Interesting. So the what was your husband Lou's involvement with the congregation?
Almost everything.
Yeah. I understand one of the things he did was preparing bodies. And so you've said because he did it, you did it. Can you talk about the meaning of that tradition for people who may not be familiar with the conservative and Orthodox Judaism?
A mitzvah is a good deed in Jewish religion. And the greatest good deed that you can do is to do something for someone who cannot return the favor. And so preparing a body for burial, obviously, is a good deed that you do for someone who cannot return that favor. And eventually, Lou, as the congregation aged and they needed somebody younger like Lou, he was asked to help with the Chevra Kedusha Committee. And then they needed, and that was for men. And then they needed women to do the same thing. And I thought, if he can do it, I can do it. And so I did that a few times as needed. Not every Jewish person wanted that done, but those who did, it was a very special good deed to do.
How difficult, if it is, how difficult of an experience is that?
It's your responsibility.
I wonder if that experience of doing that taught you anything about life and death.
Taught me to be stronger, more compassionate, and realize that I could do anything that I made up my mind I could do. Made me a strong person.
Yeah. When did Congregation Anshe Knesset Israel close?
It was either 2012 or 2013. I was the youngest person. That was, I was in my 70s, I think. That was, I was the youngest person, I think, who wasn't working, who could do that. And I had the help of the maintenance man at Mervis Industries. And so I was able to give away all the books to a seminary up in Skokie, give away all the kosher pans and dishes to Hillel at Indiana University, or Chabad in Champaign at the University of Illinois. I was able to give away almost everything and empty the building. And then someone came to us and wanted to buy it. It was, I believe, a Muslim community, and Lou sold the building to them. And it was very interesting that at the calling for Lou's funeral, the first person in line was a Muslim man who came up to us as we were standing at the funeral home and said that Lou Mervis was the only one who would sell them a church building in the Danville community.
What a remarkable story about America that you mentioned. This congregation was once in a building that had been a Catholic church, and then it was, and in a different building, I believe you said Baptist, and then it's a synagogue, and I guess now it's a mosque or some sort of Islamic center. I feel like there's a story of America and change and time in there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I can only imagine how difficult this must have been, parting with, you know, this. I can't remember if you mentioned this now, but I read somewhere that the stained glass went to Indiana University.
They will go to Hillel Indiana University if they ever can afford to build a new building.
I see. Okay. And I understand the congregant, the deceased congregants from Danville are memorialized at a synagogue in Carmel, Indiana.
Yes.
So they have their...
They were building a beautiful, beautiful synagogue in Carmel, Indiana. And my son, Michael, was involved. And somehow he and Lou arranged for all our memorial plaques, which I didn't realize are the most important thing that you have to deal with when you close a synagogue, or what's going to happen to our memorial plaques. And those are now all on the wall of Shari Tefila Synagogue in Carmel, Indiana.
Again, for people who are not familiar with the Jewish tradition, what is a memorial plaque?
It's a plaque that you put on the wall of a sanctuary that gives the birth and death date in both Hebrew and English for the person who is deceased. And on the anniversary of their death, their name is announced from the pulpit and a prayer is said for them every year.
That's lovely. That's lovely. And so those will live on, I guess, in
yes,
a way.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So other than yourself, so you said you go to Carmel for, I guess, certain holidays, probably not every week. That's a long drive.
Yes.
Do you know of where anyone else who used to be a part of that temple in Danville goes now?
No. One is in a wheelchair, so he's not going anyplace. And I don't believe that one of the other four goes anywhere.
Yeah. What drew you? Oh, you said your son lives in Carmel. I guess that's what drew you. How does that synagogue differ from your experience in Danville?
Well, first of all, there are a lot of Jewish people there. So they have a big congregation. That's the biggest difference. They have a full-time rabbi, which we didn't. They have a cantor, who is a person who sings the prayers. And it's a functioning organization. We had a functioning organization for years, but not in the last 10 years of the life of our synagogue.
Mm.
Back then, Jewish people needed to stick together. They weren't accepted in the outer community.
Yeah.
And so they needed to stick together, and it was important that they had their own organizations and that they socialized together often.
I understand you were bat mitzvah there. This is something we typically think of as happening to teenagers, but you chose to do it there in May, just this year. Can
Jewish girls are bat mitzvahed at 12 and a half. There wasn't a bat mitzvah ceremony back when I was 12 and a half in 1947. They didn't do that for girls. And so all of my grandchildren have been bar and bat mitzvahed, and I envied them because it was something I missed. I've been pretty involved as a Jewish person in my religion for a small town. And so I studied with Rabbi Teichtel in Champaign and my rabbi in Carmel, Indiana. And I was able to read four whole lines of Hebrew, which is far less than most bar and bat mitzvah students do. But they didn't teach Hebrew in my congregation. It was a very German Reform congregation that I grew up in Bloomington.
Interesting.
And so I did that, and I studied the Torah portion, and I gave a speech, and I was very proud to finally, at Jeepers 88, become a bat mitzvah. I was the oldest bat mitzvah the rabbi had ever had.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thank
We're
going to
take another break on the program. We'll have more with Sybil Mervis on Jewish life and culture and history in Central Illinois. This is the 21st Show. Please stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are spending the program today revisiting a conversation on Jewish life and community in Central Illinois over the past century. Last October, I spoke with Sybil Mervis, a longtime resident of the area. She helped set up the Central Illinois Jewish Communities Archive to document that history. We'll also talk with Amanda Riggenbach, a grad student archivist at the University of Illinois who worked with Sybil and the archive. Because our program is on tape today, we are not taking calls, but you can let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Sybil, I want to ask you, you mentioned before the break that Jewish people had to stick together back then. And you also talked about earlier about how companies would not hire, you know, major corporations would not hire people who are Jewish, for example. I wonder if assimilation, acceptance, and, you know, setting aside the rising anti-Semitism we've seen in the last few years here in America, if that has in some ways undermined Jewish community, especially in smaller town America.
Obviously it has, because Jewish young people moved out to better opportunities in larger cities where there was a larger mass of Jewish people to be friends with.
Why was it so important for you to set up the Central Illinois Jewish Archives? What was your role in that?
It's called the Central Illinois Jewish Communities Archive.
Thank you.
And it was very important to set up because these Jewish communities are all fading away, and there has to be some record about how Jewish people supported their communities in each of these towns across Central Illinois. And nobody's doing any history project on them. And I felt that it was important that that history be preserved in some way. Erez Cohen, who was head of Hillel, evidently went to the University of Illinois library system and suggested that this was a possibility, and they decided they would do it. And now there's information and records flowing in from all kinds of Jewish communities across Central Illinois. If they hadn't already sent their materials to Hebrew Union College archives, then they're coming to the University of Illinois Central Illinois Jewish Communities Archive.
Amanda Riggenbach, I want to bring you into the conversation. Now, how did you get involved with the archive?
So I am a master's student in my library and information science program, and I saw this position for a graduate assistantship with this collection, and I got involved with Jewish communities when I was living in Austria on a grant doing oral histories. And there was something incredibly welcoming about these communities, and I thought I wanted to continue learning at home. I'm from Illinois. And so I applied for the assistantship, and I was incredibly lucky to get it. And in the year I've been here, and I have another year until I complete my master's, I've been so lucky to get to work with Sybil and so many other community members across Central Illinois who really, you know, are working to make these places better and welcoming and whatnot. Just going through records of, you know, Sinai Temple here in Champaign, or the Jewish Federation of Springfield. These are the records I've been processing. It's such a testament to resilience and whatnot. So that's a long answer, but yeah, That's how I got involved.
And you yourself, you're not Jewish, I understand. What's it been like working with this material, keeping these memories alive?
Yeah, no, it's been one of those processes where I feel very lucky to be allowed access and being able to take part in preserving these legacies, I think, is one of those, it's just the right thing to do. And to be a part of a huge, amazing university library system that is, you know, actively working to preserve and document, like Sybil said, communities that aren't, you know, as active. You know, we talked about Temple B'nai Abraham in Decatur. Their building is closed, but, you know, we did an oral history interview, one of the former graduate student archivists, And, you know, in 2022, after the building closed, you still had congregants meeting in houses and still maintaining their community. And so it's up to us, you know, as archivists to go in and to make sure that that's not forgotten. And so it's been amazing to have people like Sybil to kind of open these doors and allow us to take part and to be involved.
Sybil Mervis, what were some of the responses you got when you started reaching out to people about creating an archive like this?
They were very interested in it because it preserves our history, which otherwise would be lost, absolutely lost. And Jewish people did a lot of wonderful things in Danville alone. They were involved in the establishment of the community college, the establishment of the symphony orchestra, the establishment of the gifted program in the public schools, and the establishment of the what is now called Vermilion Advantage, which is our economic development arm. So Jews made a real contribution in small towns, and that needs to be recorded somehow. It would be a great research project for somebody who wanted to work on a master's degree. If I were 40 years old, that's what I'd be doing right now.
Amanda, you've spoken about what it means to make connections in the community. What has your relationship been like with Sybil? What have you learned from her?
Oh my goodness. How to even begin with what I've learned from Sybil? I remember the first time that I met her, I was so nervous because in the archive, she is such a force, you know? I mean, she's the person who really helped start this thing. And I was so nervous. And she came in and she's direct, but she has always been willing and generous with her time to teach me things, to tell her stories, to share materials. One of these items includes some diaries from, is Sadie?
Cousin Sadie Stern in Springfield.
Yeah, these amazing diaries from 1914 to 1918 that will soon become publicly available in our collection. You know, she's just always so generous and kind. She was so wonderful to invite me to a Hanukkah dinner and just to be so immersed in the culture that I've been able to, you know, look at these materials to look at and to see. But Sybil has been, you know, done the extra things and has made me feel so welcome. And I don't think there's anything I could do to repay her for that.
Is it challenging to, I mean, you become so embedded in the community in this work, and then at some point, I imagine you're going to have to turn it over to another graduate student. Do you have a sense of what that's like?
Well, the way that the structure was set up is I do believe that it was set up for 5 years for the graduate assistant or the graduate archivist. And so ideally, there will be more to come in the future. You know, but at this moment, yeah, I feel like a lot of love towards it. I've done a lot of work in oral history previously. And so getting to do that, those projects and making those kinds of connections with community members gives me a lot of love and a lot of heart. And so the idea of leaving and, you know, these manuscripts, these materials being in someone else's hands, it's kind of the process. It's important. And it's the way that you make sure that the standards are really high. But also, there's so much heart and love put into it. It's definitely a conflicted feeling. You have that right.
I can imagine that. So what ultimately becomes of this material? You mentioned the diary that was going to become publicly available. Is this something for researchers? Is it going to be exhibits? Will it be digitized? If people are interested in learning more using some of these archives, how can they do that?
I love that you asked this question because I really didn't understand how archives functioned before I started working in them. And so I love to explain how it works, especially the how we function. So the Central Illinois Jewish Communities Archives is part of the Illinois History and Lincoln Collections, which is in the main library at the University of Illinois. Okay, that was a lot, I understand. But essentially, anyone, public, from the public, you can come from Portland, Maine, and come visit our library and say, hey, I would like to see, you know, Sadie Stern's diaries, and we'll get you set up in our system and you can sit in our reading room and look through them. You're welcome to take pictures. Just no flash, please. We're trying to keep these for the future for a very long time. And so that's what I mean when they'll become publicly available. Yes, we want researchers. We want people to, you know, have master's thesis focused around these topics, around these communities. But we also want community members to feel welcome in this space, to come and learn about their history. The university library has amazing digitization services. And so that's something that we definitely can look at in the future. But one of the main and most important things within the archive is making things accessible. And so we need to create, we need to catalog them and create finding aids, things that make it searchable and findable online, and simply so that people know that we have these. So right now, you know, you wouldn't know that we had these diaries because they haven't really been put into our system yet. But that's one of my semester checklist items. So by December, please look for Sadie Stern's diaries.
Will do. Sybil Mervis, we're coming to the end of our time together. I want to ask, what has kept you in Central Illinois, as so many of other Jewish people have left for places like, I mean, Champaign-Urbana, Indianapolis, Chicago, Florida, Arizona, New York? What keeps you here?
Love of the land, the peace and quiet of living in Central Illinois. I don't want to be with a lot of people, for example, in Chicago. I certainly don't want to be in Florida, where the governor is a maniac. I want to be where it's peaceful. I have a big garden. I helped my daddy with a victory garden when I was a little girl, so I've gardened almost every year since. This year I was growing lots of extra vegetables to take to food pantries, and that's very satisfying. I love being part of Illinois. I wouldn't want to live anyplace else in the world.
How do you hope people will remember the Central Illinois Jewish communities?
Through the archive, there'll always be information about how we lived, how we contributed to the communities that we lived in, and why and how we got here. And I think it's wonderful to have that much of a history. If I were advising somebody who was looking around for some kind of master's degree research, I'd suggest that they work on that particular area, because there's so much that hasn't been recorded that needs to be recorded. And I'd love to see several people working on degrees that investigated more about how Jews contributed to Central Illinois.
And do you have any thoughts on keeping communities together, trying to maintain that Jewish community that, as we've talked about, has in some ways sort of spread out and dissipated, especially in smaller towns?
It's too dissipated to keep them together anymore. Mm. That sounds negative, but that's the honest truth.
The truth is what we're after. Sybil Mervis is helped set up the Central Illinois Jewish Communities Archive. We've also spoken with Amanda Riggenbach, a graduate student archivist at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, who's worked directly on that. Amanda, and especially Sybil, thank you so much for sharing your story and your work with us today on the 21st Show.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you so much. And I also just want to say that having Sybil here in Central Illinois has made it better. And so we are grateful that she is here. And at the archive, we love her. So thank you, Sybil.
Thank you both. That's it for us today. Before we go, a long overdue farewell to one of our colleagues. Today's program was originally produced by Harrison Malkin. Harrison came to us early in 2025. He's based in New York, but had previously worked at Illinois Public Media covering politics a few years ago. Harrison brought an ambitious Rolodex to our show, booking big-name guests like National Democratic politician Stacey Abrams and the novelist and Atlantic writer George Packer. He also had ideas for programs we might not have come across, but for his wide-ranging interests. Today's conversation is an example of that. So also was a show we did on the link between scent and sound. Because the Trump administration and Congress withdrew federal funding for public media, Harrison's hours were cut back. He understandably sought and found full-time work elsewhere. Harrison, I just want to say thank you. I already miss collaborating with you, and I wish you best of luck in the future. With that, The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.